Patricia Camilleri, Director of the Communications and Alumni Relations Office here at the University. In this series called Research Matters, I shall be discussing a wide range of research projects in which our academics are currently involved. My guest today is Dr. Marvin Formosa from the European Centre for Gerontology here at the University of Malta. Welcome, Dr. Formosa.
Thank you.
You're going to talk to us today about a European project called e-learning in later life. I think this is an extremely topical subject, and I look forward to hearing all about it. Tell us how the project was initiated, how you got involved.
First of all, however, I would like to put it much more in the context. I mean, how did it emerge? Why is it important? Why were the partners granted so many euros for its execution? And I think we need to put the European project, it was called ELIL, e-learning in later life, in the context of two very important dimensions. First of all, the changing of the definition of education. As the listeners, of course, are aware, there was a memorandum in the year 2000, especially for us in the European Union now, which was called Memorandum on Lifelong Learning, and it redefined the meaning of education, in a sense we're now talking about learning and not education. What's the difference between education and learning? Because this is very important. The title isn't e-education and later what e-learning. The basic difference between education and learning is that in education it's a very top bottom down type of approach. There's the tutor, there's the student, and it's like the tutor knows most of the things and the student is responsible to learn. In learning, of course, the face-to-face interaction between the tutor and the student is there, but it continues even after they leave each other, in the sense that the learner is also responsible. So that's one very important thing that we need to understand, and of course that's why then e-learning, which basically means learning through the means of computer technology, or of course web technology, internet. So it's different from distance learning, because distance learning, it's also learning through the basis of the mass media. At the same time, also there is of course the coming of population aging. If we talk about European Union, in about 14-15 years time, about 20-19% of the population in the European Union will be of the age of 60. If we look at the Maltese scenario, in the year 2025, 24.6% of the people in Malta will be above the age of 60. So that basically means when you go to Valletta, one out of every four walking down, the streets will be an older person. And of course, this has revolutionized the area of adult education. So just as much as we want, more women to become involved in adult education, more people from diverse ethnic backgrounds, we also are working towards the involvement of older people, because we believe, of course, that older people, let's say somebody who's 70 years of age, is different from somebody who is 30, who's 28, who's 26, qualitatively different, because of course they have such a background. So this project focus on these two issues. But of course, since you cannot do everything, you have to focus on something. We focused on trying to improve the literacy, the digital literacy of older people, in order to help them to participate in lifelong learning. So that's the basic aim. That's the most important aim. And because we know that since lifelong learning is also self-directed, and most of learning today occurs through the internet, through online, the partners most importantly wanted to come up with a project in which we first would explore the issue, then we would kind of make a study and test our hypothesis, our assumptions, and then end up with providing a report. It's in front of me now, with examples of good practice, because of course not everything is a good practice, or something may be much more successful than another.
I would have thought that talking about e-learning amongst older people would be quite difficult, considering that most of those who you're talking about, the over 60s, would have had less experience with electronic media than their younger colleagues. Mm-hmm. So this was an effort to try and also find ways and means of encouraging them to use this electronic media?
Yes, of course. When we discuss internet technology, computer technology and older people, there's a fact and a myth. The fact is that statistically, yes, lower percentages of older people are digital illiterate when you compare the teenagers with older people, of course. But the myth is the number and percentage of older people who are computer literate are much higher than we think. So to address a group of older people as if they are all digitally illiterate, that's a result of age discrimination. That's a result of an ageist stereotype. But of course, any project dealing with e-learning with older people must also involve an introductory phase, because it's not really one session, because this is a phase, everything takes time, to introduce and to, there's a level of teaching, yes, as well, to teach older people not how to use the computer, not how to use the internet, because that's very primary type of education, but to be confident, but to be comfortable using it, and also to believe in themselves.
Of course, one only has to cast around a little bit to find people of a certain age who are definitely not technophobic. I have a friend of mine's father, he's 85 or more, and he's into the latest gizmos, always buying the latest equipment and keeping in contact with his family abroad through webcam and all that kind of thing. So, yes, probably, as you say, much of our thinking about older people and technology is a myth rather than reality. How did you actually go about finding out what was best practice?
Okay, it's a very good question. First of all, older adult education, scholars have been working in the field in older adult education since the mid-70s, since 1976. The first paper on older adult education was published in 1976, although, of course, you'll find other papers even as much as 8 years ago. But as a specific discipline, educational gerontology was founded, or as the term was founded in the mid-70s. So it's not that we started, you know, from a vacuum. The listeners, of course, would know that, would be familiar with the words pedagogy, andragogy, which basically means techniques how to teach adults. And in later life, in educational gerontology, we have the concept of gerogogy, which or geragogy. The Americans call it gerogogy, and we call it geragogy on the side of the Atlantic. So there are books and articles written on how it's best to teach older people. And of course, it's not because older people are different, they're not subaltern adults, but because it's basically different to teach somebody who experienced the Second World War than somebody who barely remembers the late 70s. So that's a big difference. So we started from these principles, and basically these principles say to acknowledge their experience, to arrange the curriculum together with the student, of course, with the students. Sometimes we don't really call them students, sometimes we call them, you know, members and colleagues in the learning experience. And also to share how it is best to plan or to create the lectures, etc. So there's a wealth of information as regards how the teaching skills of the people. But of course, now we entered into online learning, into e-learning. And of course, we try to sensitize these general concepts of teaching other persons, and we try to discover to what extent are they related, are they can be transferred to e-learning. So many of the concepts remained. So of course, you must be interested in the methods that we employed, and it's good to say that there were three phases of the project. There was the exploratory phase, which was much more very exploratory in the sense that we explored the subject, this paper. It was very scholarly. But then the second phase was practical. So we involved ourselves with all the people, and we and the partners employed tutors after they were given adequate training. And it's also fair to say that we also had a session in Ulm, by more expert people in the field. So it's, you never know enough. And we had a group of older people who were involved in classes, and they were being taught what we call blended learning. So there were face-to-face teaching sessions, but at the same time, after the teaching session finished, it was a two-hour teaching session, they could go home and there are certain techniques, we can discuss this later, like Moodle and teleconferencing. The learning experience would continue even throughout, let's say, the next 6-7 days before they meet again. And of course, then we compare them with other people who are just involved in the traditional type, in the classroom setting of education. And of course, we found, not of course, we didn't know, but we expected to find this, that all the people who were involved in e-learning, their enrichment was much more successful, was much more advanced. And of course, you could say that they learned more, but that for us was only a means to an end. It's not the end in itself, because we believe that education, first of all, it has a holistic meaning, but more than so, when you are in your later life, you're not interested in getting a promotion or a new job. You may be learning some skills to become, perhaps to enter some kind of part-time job. That may happen too. But mostly, older people, generally speaking, learn as an end in itself. And what I enjoyed more personally was that from the feedback of the older people, of the older learners, they were very much happy. Emotional well-being also improved. So it wasn't a question of knowing much more about something. It wasn't about increasing one's knowledge, you know, but it was also feeling good about one's skills, one's opportunities in life, feeling their self-esteem also increase, you know, and even their locus of control. I mean, what usually happens, my dad is in his late 60s, now he's computer literate, but when he wasn't, he used to phone me and he used to tell me, oh, they told me to go on the internet, but I really don't know it. And then you could feel, you know, his locus of control, you know, being very down, because I can do it. It's like helplessness. So this is another side of the project, which I think should not be underestimated.
Before continuing to talk to Dr. Marvin Formosa about this interesting subject of learning in later life, I'd just like to remind listeners that this is Patricia Camilleri, and we're talking on research matters. Marvin, the people who were interviewed, the people who you researched on, were they chosen randomly? Did it make any difference what their own backgrounds were when it came to this increased enrichment?
Ideally, you should have a wide spectrum of people in research. Ideally, the informants would be representative of the wider population. But of course, we were not doing a survey, so we needed people who wanted to come to the. So we had a certain level. There's always a limitation. But we tried to get a wide spectrum as much as possible. And I think we also, the listeners should know that they were not Maltese. They were German, because the key partner was the University of Ulm. Other partners were from Finland, the Czech Republic, Slovakia, and Spain. But primary partners were in Ulm, German University of Ulm. So, of course, but we tried to get a wide spectrum as much as possible. Remember, this was much more of a qualitative focus group, qualitative study rather than a survey. And, however, it was easy to see certain divergences, as you said, their background. And, of course, we focused on class, gender, and ethnic minorities. Class, of course, the definition of class is a big debate even today, but generally speaking, you would say that the higher their level of education and the higher their occupational ranking when prior to retirement, the better that they involve themselves in the research. But that is, of course, something which we expected, because if somebody is trained, you know, and if somebody has a long experience in clerical work, for example, is different from somebody who was involved in construction. So, for example, that taught us that, for example, in order to reach people with low levels of education, in order to reach people with perhaps an experience of low-income occupations, we can call them that, so as not to be judgmental, you need to do a lot of outreach work. You need to go out in the community and try to make them interested. Gender, females, of course, were much more interested than males.
You say, of course?
Yes, of course. You could say that, of course. First of all, older females are roaring to get out, are roaring to interact, because they would have their experiences like of some 30, 25 years of child-rearing responsibility. child homemaking responsibilities, whereas the husband would have, you know, been working and perhaps would have even gone abroad or on trips or meeting lots of people at the workplace. So what happens in later life? The older woman is much more active than the older male. So even in Malta, if you go to any, if you go to the university of the third age, if you go to adult education, if you go to sometimes parish priests make some kind of they plan certain courses or certain talks, you know, by nutritionists, podologists. So it's always that older women tend to be overrepresentative. If not, there won't be any older males. So that's something which we also learn, and that of course goes against the class issue, because one would expect that since older males have, you know, more experience in occupations that most probably would have introduced them to the computer, they would be much more ready. But even learning is sometimes a female thing, you know. It's like males tend to be, especially when you consider that some countries like Spain and Italy and Greece, males tend to be, you know, the results of a macho culture. So to go to a classroom to be taught and to learn, it's like
might go against the grain, the male
yes,
psyche.
And exactly, and they most probably, the males don't have a good experience of education, whereas most older women wanted to continue studying, but their parents might have told them, no, you cannot, because I have, you know, three more siblings younger than you, and you need to help me. So when I say that females are roaring to go, it's not because biologically they are different from males, but it's their biographies are different. And ethnic minorities, well, it was difficult to study this, because of course, when you're an ethnic minority, you're fewer in number than the dominant ethnic group. So it was a bit difficult. But another thing, of course, that ethnic minorities tend to have special issues, if you want to call them issues rather than problems. And usually they tend to be, their level of integration in the community usually is not as good as the others. So again, we didn't reach any ethnic minority people, to be honest, because of course, if you take somebody coming from an ethnic group, let's say in Germany, she could be Polish. I mean, not necessarily African origin. You know, you might not be dealing with the representative person. So this is something for further exploration.
You mentioned before the idea of blended education. This means that obviously we're not talking just about somebody at home behind a computer. In this experiment that you did, research that you did in these groups, did you manage to use diverse approaches to learning?
Yes, basically blended learning is the dominant belief today, that learning throughout life is best coordinated through a blended approach, which basically means both being, you know, the traditional style, teacher, student in a classroom, but also containing lots of distance education as well. So even primary school children nowadays, of course, I mean, they are encouraged to go home and continue looking further into this subject. When in my times, you know, we used to have an encyclopedia either at home or at the library, and we would continue reading over there. Today, we know that many people would go on the internet, and perhaps Wikipedia and even Encyclopedia Britannica, they're available today. So with the older people, there is this problem that if they are digitally illiterate or they're not confident or comfortable, they're losing out of the learning experience. The focus was on e-learning, in the sense that we were saying, I mean, the sense was, we were saying, listen, older people have a lot of experience of classroom-style teaching. And of course, when we make a call, you know, for a classroom style of lecture, it's always oversubscribed. But that's only part of the education experience. Another part of the education experience today is self-directed learning. And again, in the past, self-directed learning meant going to the library. That basically was it. Today, self-directed learning is using the internet rather than the computer, but sometimes even the computer, because today there are CD-ROMs, you know. So we tried as much as possible. I mean, as I say, the project, of course, cannot do everything, and it shouldn't do everything. It's better to focus on something, doing well, and see exactly what it results. So we tried to come up with some kind of, well, philosophical and practical report, because here the report has also theoretical parts and also practical parts, of how we can increase the learning experience of older people. And hopefully, because this is something which we need to gauge in the long term, hopefully, if today, you know, the NSO states that, you know, only 6% of older people, I'm inventing right now, are involved in blended learning, hopefully in 10 years' time, this 6% would go to 30%. But of course, in the meantime, a lot of work must be done by, of course, the government, educational institutions, and also the NGOs and the older persons themselves.
The report that you're talking about, mm-hmm. that is the tangible evidence of what went on during your research. A document like that, where does it end up? On whose desk does it end up? Is it possible for it to actually influence policy? This is a question that I try to ask all our researchers, because I think people think that perhaps research happens in a bit of a vacuum. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's always interesting to know if that research actually, at the end of the day, can be translated into action.
Mm-hmm. Now, in democratic countries, and of course, we're never as democratic as we want to be, because there are always some voices which are not being heard. But we're lucky we live in a democratic country, in a democratic European Union, where at least the constituted bodies are successful in having their voices heard. And we are also lucky in the sense that older people are part of this, are a member, are one of these constituted bodies. And so in this climate of civil society, there's a good possibility, you know, it is encouraging that when a policy is presented, you know, a white paper, there's always some time for discussion. And so today the climate is much better than it was surely 20, 30 years ago, not just in Malta, but everywhere in the world where the governments usually is to adopt a policy and, you know, take it or leave it. Today there's a lot of discussion between the government and civil society. At the same time, of course, the partners are all very much present and influential in other high-ranking organizations like Platform, with Age Platform. It's recognized by the European Union as being the platform. It's an umbrella organization for different age-interested organizations throughout Europe. So, of course, yes, I think the future is bright. It's not an overnight thing. It's not an overnight thing because, as you can see, Patricia, it's 2006, 2008. So the project, strictly speaking, there's still some evaluations going on. It's not really finished. And, of course, from my limited experience in life, you always need 36 months, you know, some 3 years to change organizations, how they think, you know, to get them on your side. It takes time to get them on your side. And then there's the problem also of financial requirements, because to do things, to implement things, you need money. Unfortunately, that's a fact in life. But again, today it's good that there's the ESF, the Social Fund, European Social Fund, and I'm sure that there will be lots of opportunities for people interested in this field. I mean, to be honest, although one needs money to implement e-learning, it's not as expensive as you might think. The software is expensive, but usually once you buy it, it's yours. And, I mean, University of Malta also provides very much subsidized from the IT center. You can buy Microsoft Word at very subsidized rate if you're a student. Mm-hmm. So that is something which I also encourage all the people, you know, the people to subscribe or to become a member in the University of the Third Age. And
In fact, in the last couple of minutes, little short time mm-hmm. that we have left, I would like to focus just a little bit on the situation here in Malta. I mean, we've had for many years now the University of the Third Age. Obviously, one could have a whole program talking mm-hmm. about that. But are there also other areas within the community? Do you think the local councils have helped to increase an awareness of education within this age bracket?
Well, no. Unfortunately, my answer is, with great displeasure, my answer is no. Unfortunately, older adult education still, like I said, is very Cinderella subject. I mean, adult education began very much a Cinderella subject way back in the 50s and 60s. It was basically started by the trade unions, and then it was caught up by the government. And it's only about 10 years ago since, you know, lifelong learning became a dominant policy in the European Union. So at the moment, we're trying to implement practically the analytical positions present in the memorandum of lifelong learning. And of course, one could imagine the state of older adult education is much more something which we haven't really started. I mean, older adult education, or let's say the encouragement and involvement of older people in learning should become, of course, a much more wide ranging policy, in the sense it should be present in the local councils, which today they haven't done anything much for adult education, much less for older adult education. Of course, residential homes for older people, even the nursing home of St. Vincent de Paul, although something is being done there. They've got a leisure officer, or you could call her an educational officer, which does a lot of good work, and we must acknowledge that. But even...
It hasn't become mainstream thinking.
No, it hasn't become mainstream. I mean, this self-help movement did not really catch on in Malta. In England, there's a good tradition of self-help movement. A number of older people interested in a particular subject, and they basically meet in somebody's house, and, you know, and they get tea and coffee on their own, and they invite somebody to come and, you know, discuss the issue. In Malta, I think we're still too much centralized in our thinking. So I think all the people, like anybody else, like adults, and they want something, they should try and see how they can get it by their own. It's not like, I'm not advocating that governments, education institutions like the University of Malta have a moral obligation to provide education opportunities for all the people. So of course that is a sine qua non, that is something which should be present and much more. But at the same time, you know, all the people should be also proactive.
Well, thank you very, very much, Dr. Formosa, for coming to talk to us today.
It was a pleasure.
If you would like further details about the University of Malta's research projects or any other information, please access our website at www.um.edu.mt. Do join me again next week. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.